This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. You've likely heard the words vaccine mandate thrown around a few times, and maybe you have an understanding of what it means, but did you know there's an entire historical context for vaccine mandates and laws that date back more than 120 years? Today, we'll be learning more about the background history, as well as what is happening now and where things look to be headed in the future. With us to talk more about it all is Brian Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University and author of the Bloomberg AHLA Treaties Vaccine, Vaccination and Immunization Law. We're going to spend the hour today learning about the fascinating intricacies of vaccine law and how it ties into broader topics as well. Thank you so much for joining us, Brian.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into a more detailed discussion, can you break down for us what vaccine law is exactly?
Well, vaccine law really is a collection of different laws and different areas of the law that all direct the country towards this sort of public policy favoring a vaccination of the population against contagious disease. So you find things in the regulatory structures and intellectual property and in constitutional law and, of course, with respect to vaccine mandates, and then also with vaccine injury compensation systems and systems that have been set up to track vaccination rates and who is vaccinated and who can be, for example, admitted to primary or elementary school based on their vaccination status. So there's this wide array of areas in which the law bends towards vaccination as a preference that society has decided upon over the centuries since the technology was invented.
Well, Brian, in order to understand what's happening now in terms of vaccine law and mandates, it's important to look back at the history of this topic, particularly here in the U.S. Where does this idea of laws governing vaccinations begin?
You know, the idea of having laws governing vaccination goes back all the way to the development of vaccines. The first vaccine, the smallpox vaccine, was invented in 1796 by Dr. Edward Jenner, an English physician. And fairly shortly after he published his results, finding that you could inoculate someone against smallpox, this was widely heralded by the scientific community around the world and adopted by the governments of many countries, which instituted efforts to promote vaccination, although not necessarily immediately to mandate vaccination. However, smallpox was a very deadly disease. It was a scourge of mankind that could roll through a town and kill one out of every six people in that town. So as smallpox epidemics developed, cities and countries began mandating vaccination of the population in areas that were being affected by this disease. And early on, these mandates were actually, you know, they had objectors, but they didn't meet a lot of legal resistance. It wasn't until towards the end of the 19th century that there started to be people who filed lawsuits asserting, in the United States at least, that it was beyond the power of the government to mandate vaccination. And this was finally resolved in the United States Supreme Court in a 1905 case called Jacobson v. Massachusetts. Mr. Jacobson was a Massachusetts pastor, and he asserted that he had previously been vaccinated for smallpox because it's one of those diseases where you would have to be vaccinated every number of years to maintain immunity, and that he had a very bad experience when he was vaccinated previously and was afraid that he might die from being vaccinated again. And he pointed to family members who had also had very bad vaccination experiences. And at the time, everyone in the city of Boston was legally required to be vaccinated or have to pay a fine, an amount that would be about $150 today. And the Supreme Court held that it was within the police power of the state to protect the health of the citizens, to mandate vaccination of all people to prevent the spread of a disease like that.
That's fascinating that back in 1905 in this time period you're talking about, there were fines instituted for folks who weren't getting vaccinated. When did that sort of start to change?
Well, in 1922, there was another Supreme Court case, and it's the last case involving where the Supreme Court directly examined a law mandating vaccination. And this one said that all students entering school in San Antonio, whether public or private schools, would be required to be vaccinated. And again, this is the smallpox vaccine. For the first 120 years in the history of vaccines, we're talking about the smallpox vaccine almost exclusively. The law required that all students be vaccinated in order to attend school. And the Supreme Court, in a fairly short and direct to the point opinion, said, looking back at Jacobson, we said that you could fine people for not being vaccinated. It is sort of a lesser included power to say that you can restrict people from exercising certain rights, such as attending school, if they are unvaccinated. And that primarily has been the means by which vaccination has been promoted over the course of the century. Since then, it has been by those with the power to grant access to education or employment or some benefit like that, say, well, we're not going to allow you to have access to this unless you're vaccinated. Over the course of the century, particularly in periods in the 1920s and 30s, and then again in the 60s and 70s, many new vaccines were developed. So we saw the development of vaccines for measles, mumps, and rubella, for polio, which was a very heralded and celebrated occurrence because that too was terribly infecting the country at the time that the vaccine was developed. And then later for things like pneumococcal pneumonia and meningococcal meningitis. And as these new vaccines were developed, increasingly vaccines were required for students entering school to the point where by the late 1970s, early 1980s, every state in the United States required some set of vaccines, primarily the same set of vaccines with some exceptions, some additional things in specific states. And that also was the point at which there was sort of the development of movements to limit the ability of states to mandate vaccination, which has led to some of the conflict that we see today with people who are opposed to vaccination.
So it seems like that was kind of brewing over time, and maybe now with all the social media and access to things, it's kind of exploded.
Yes, it very much has. You know, really, there has been some opposition to vaccination ever since the first vaccine was developed. There were people who thought it was unnatural. There were people who thought it was against God's will to protect yourself from disease because it was God's decision who lived or died. There were people who didn't understand kind of the science of it, even at the very beginning, and thought that people were being given animal cells and that would partially transform them into animals from receiving the smallpox vaccine. You know, there are tremendous things along those lines that developed as fears at the very beginning of vaccination. And some of those have basically transformed into modern myths that are promulgated with respect to vaccines and modern concerns that are expressed.
Well, despite the fears, it seems that smallpox and the vaccination efforts paid off. You know, it was eliminated. Shouldn't that be something that we're celebrating, that we hear more about, to encourage, you know, modern day vaccines?
You know, there's a great Supreme Court opinion from 2011, written by Justice Antonin Scalia, where he wrote about a separate area of vaccine law where vaccine manufacturers were immunized from liability for injury caused by vaccines or alleged to be caused by vaccines. And he wrote in that opinion that vaccines were a victim of their own success. They had been so successful in eliminating the diseases for which they were developed that people have forgotten to fear those diseases and instead are more afraid of the very rare, although, you know, occasionally occurring, adverse events from vaccination. And that's really kind of a development that we're seeing blossom now. So the eradication of smallpox actually required a global vaccination effort, as the eradication of any disease would. And that involved countries that were at war with each other suspending their military activities so that World Health Organization personnel could go in and vaccinate populations. It involved finding pockets of smallpox wherever they were occurring in the world and intensively vaccinating everyone in a substantial zone around where that had occurred. And it was a years-long process, really a slog that a lot of professionals underwent in order to eliminate one of the what had once been one of the deadliest diseases in human history from the planet altogether. And there are other diseases that could be eradicated in this way, polio, measles, and so forth, if we had similar efforts, if we had a similar level of worldwide focus on vaccination of the populations against those specific diseases.
I think that's a key point there is if we all were on the same page. And I mean, it's impressive to think about what was done in the past. Is anyone taking lessons from those experiences that you know of in terms of mandates or laws or anything like that?
Well, historically, it wasn't necessary to impose a vaccination mandate to eliminate smallpox during the period during which eradication was being undertaken, because really the world wanted smallpox to be gone, and there wasn't this tremendous resistance to it. Mandates have proven to be very effective in getting people to be vaccinated who otherwise aren't thinking about it. You know, especially if you have children and you're getting them into school, you have a lot of priorities and different things competing with each other. So parents might not necessarily think about vaccination, particularly with respect to some of the diseases that are less common or less commonly vaccinated against, like rotavirus. But having mandates does make it a lot more clear cut that this is something that is beneficial to children and that they need in order to attend school. It's a bit different when we get into mandates for vaccines for diseases that typically afflict adults, like influenza, and now, of course, as we are experiencing with COVID-19. And in those cases, you know, we are looking, first of all, at preventing the spread of disease and limiting the ability of the disease to get into people. And by doing that, also limiting the ability of the disease to mutate and form additional kind of variants that can be very harmful. And, you know, we're also trying to kind of protect people from themselves, which is, of course, a difficult task to undertake.
Absolutely. Well, coming up, we'll continue our discussion with Brian Abramson on vaccine mandates with a look at the present, what's happening now, and where Indiana fits in with it all. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Zobe. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're spending the hour today discussing the history of vaccine laws and mandates and how it all comes into play currently. With us is vaccine law expert Brian Dean Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University and author of the Bloomberg AHLA Treatise, Vaccine, Vaccination, and Immunization Law. A little later on the program, we'll get into the details of what teenagers can do if they want to get vaccinated, even if their parents don't want them to. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Before the break, we discussed the background of vaccine laws and the historical context. I want to shift a little to the president, to the present. President Biden is expected to sign an executive order today that all government employees must be vaccinated and they can't opt out by getting regularly tested for COVID. How unusual is this move, or is it on par with past pandemics?
It is actually quite unusual. This is a very strong response to the coronavirus pandemic specifically. And it's also important to understand that in past pandemics, typically, if you look at, for example, the Spanish flu of 1918, no vaccine was developed for that pandemic. And a lot of times when we have something like SARS or the swine flu or something like that, there isn't a development of a vaccine in time to address the pandemic. Usually the disease itself is something that runs a very quick course and society is kind of through with it before a vaccine is developed. Here with COVID-19, we're seeing a disease that has substantially more staying power. There's just some particular things about the way that the virus functions that are making it stick around longer. And at the same time, we saw a vaccine developed with historic speed so that we were, in fact, able to begin vaccinating people while this pandemic is ongoing, and certainly, you know, save a large number of lives by doing that. Now, an interesting aspect of Biden's expected announcement is that, of course, it affects all federal employees. It is directed to federal employees. Historically, there have been very few vaccine mandates that have come from the federal government at all. And generally, the federal government only has exercised power to mandate vaccination for military personnel, immigrants to the United States, and in some cases, federal prisoners, and occasionally, for example, federal contractors who are working with the military, where they're working with military personnel who also have to be vaccinated. And those have tended to be, you know, fairly limited. Most vaccine mandates emanate from the state governments and individual states. We have 50 states and a number of territories, and therefore, you know, have 50 different sets of laws. And although there are commonalities in those laws, they can be very different. Also, within particular states, some municipalities or counties or other subdivisions may have the authority under state law to make decisions about vaccination that are different from what is going on in other places in the states. And then finally, what we're seeing a lot more of now than we have historically are private mandates, where individual employers in a variety of fields are mandating vaccination of their employees. Now, an interesting aspect of that is that if you were to go back to the 1920s and 30s and 40s, you would find that a lot of private employers had smallpox vaccination mandates and required their employees to be vaccinated for smallpox. And the few cases that were decided that were either challenging that or challenging the liability of the employer for an asserted bad reaction to a smallpox vaccine held that this was certainly something that was within their power as employers to protect the safety of their workforce. And that was something that was prevalent during that time period. As smallpox waned in the United States, that tended to fall away. And other vaccines that were developed were vaccines that were more directed towards children, childhood conditions. So they weren't something that were necessarily relevant to employers. But beginning in the 2000s, you began to see a lot of employers, specifically in the healthcare field, and later on with airline crews and with first responders, requiring vaccination of employees for, well, first of all, to ensure that they were vaccinated against those childhood diseases and had vaccinations like measles and rubella, but also to require vaccination against influenza. And there was some litigation early on directed at the ability of employers to do that. And that was generally upheld so long as you met various requirements under federal law to provide exemptions for people with disabilities or exemptions for people with religious objections. Or to accord with labor union restrictions if you are a business that had a unionized workforce.
Well, it sounds like with this proposed executive order that people can't opt out. It says by getting regularly tested for COVID. I know that's been some of the balance that they've tried to make in different industries where it's like if you don't want to get vaccinated, at least you have to get tested once a week. But it sounds like this one is pretty strict.
Yes. And generally speaking, you know, one of the interesting quirks of this is if you look historically at school requirements for students entering school, if they have an exemption from vaccination, then typically the student is treated like every other student and there's no difference. There's no additional requirements that are imposed on them. That's been the case at the elementary and primary school and collegiate level also, where vaccinations are required by colleges and universities. When you get into the employment field, you have a different structure where it's not the government necessarily requiring that employers have a vaccinated workforce, although that does happen in some states and with respect to certain fields, but where employers on their own initiative say, we're going to require our employees to be vaccinated. If you then have an employee who says, well, I cannot be vaccinated because I have consulted with my physician and I have a contraindication to this vaccination. There's something on the label of the vaccine that says if you have this physical condition, then you shouldn't receive this vaccine. Or if they say I have a religious objection to vaccination and are able to substantiate that they have a sincerely held religious belief, at that point, the employer is required to attempt to accommodate their request. Now, there are some fields where if you're engaged in hands-on, person-to-person, face-to-face contact with patients, for example, as a physician all day long, you may not be able to be accommodated and you may not be able to work in that profession if you're unable to be vaccinated. But in many cases, you know, if you're working for a hospital in a clerical role and the hospital requires all of its staff to be vaccinated, then your inability to be vaccinated may require the hospital to seek some accommodation that where they have you work different hours or work in a different location. Now, of course, we have many people working remotely, and that's something we're going to see continuing. And being tested for disease and taking measures like wearing masks are some of the standard long-term, long-lived accommodations that have existed for a great deal of time since mandatory vaccination by employers has come into play. And what we're seeing in some of the schools now is we have these kind of hybrid exemptions where you're exempt from receiving the vaccination, but you're treated as though you've been accommodated under one of these regimes that applies to employers. And we're seeing schools saying, well, if you're not vaccinated, then you have to wear a mask and receive testing. You know, there is some talk, at least, about the potential of doing antibody testing to see if people have antibodies for the disease. But primarily, you know, testing to see if you have COVID on a fairly regular basis. And that's a fairly well-heeled standard for testing for determining if someone has a disease as an accommodation to allow them to have access to the things that they would have if they were vaccinated.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for our program today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're spending the hour today discussing vaccine law and mandates with vaccine law expert Brian Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University and author of the Bloomberg AHLA Treaties, Vaccine, Vaccination, and Immunization Law. Brian, when it comes to Indiana laws, the state has been cited as giving some precedent in some cases. Can you tell us about those instances?
There is one case that has come out of the state of Indiana, which is very interesting. It's Clausen versus Indiana University. Now, generally speaking, Indiana as a state has not mandated vaccination. But a number of universities in the state, and some of them public universities, have mandated vaccination. This is COVID-19 vaccination specifically of student populations. In that particular case, there were 8 students attending Indiana University who objected to the vaccination mandate. Interestingly, 7 of those 8 students qualified for exemptions from the mandate, but under the exemption, they would be required to wear a mask and receive regular testing for the disease. And they objected to this. They asserted that being required to wear a mask singles them out as unvaccinated students and, you know, potentially would subject them to some kind of discriminatory treatment. And at the same time, they objected to the vaccine itself, the fact that at the time that this suit was filed, all of the COVID vaccines available were only under an emergency use authorization. Now we do have a fully licensed vaccine, but that is still a concern that, that people have raised, that some vaccines that are available remain under emergency use authorization. And the court, the United States District Court for the Northern District of Indiana, in a really substantial 100-page opinion, which is a very long court opinion.
Yeah, that's a lot of pages.
Yes, it is. And, you know, typically you see court opinions that are 15 or 16 pages that dispose of things like this. But this judge wrote a 100-page opinion where he very thoroughly examined all of these issues. He examined in particular the question of whether Jacobson v. Massachusetts is still good law, because Jacobson, after all, was decided nearly 120 years ago. And there are some objectors to vaccination who say, well, that law is so long ago and so much has changed since then. How can it possibly still be the applicable standard? And the court reviewed that, and the fact that even though the U.S. Supreme Court has not itself addressed vaccination mandates, the court has applied Jacobson and looked to Jacobson as authority in numerous other areas of law. So, for example, where states have had laws requiring people in vegetative state to be kept on a feeding tube over the objection of their families who would rather have it removed and allow the person to die, or where schools have enacted random drug testing for students, or, you know, various other areas like that, the courts have looked to Jacobson and said, well, under the police power, you're allowed to require vaccination of people. And following from that standard, it also makes sense you'd be allowed to require this other thing. So the Supreme Court has really kept Jacobson alive. And the judge in the Claussen case recognized that and applied that and found that it was still good law. He also found that the fact that the vaccines that were authorized were under an emergency use authorization was not legally significant, because the FDA had actually engaged in a much more robust and searching practice of determining the efficacy and the safety of these vaccines than it is required to under the statute, which gives it authority to provide emergency use authorization for pharmaceuticals in response to an emergency like this. And ultimately, the court concluded that really there's no valid objection that people have to being required to wear masks and receive testing as an alternative, because after all, we as a society have been doing that for over a year now. And the same people who are objecting to that had worn masks to go shopping and to go to other places that were requiring masks. So it's really kind of a blockbuster opinion, and it's one that was very quickly upheld by the Seventh Circuit, not entirely in its substance, but the Seventh Circuit was asked to kind of put that opinion on hold pending the appeal. And the Seventh Circuit looked at it and said, you know, basically, we don't think this appeal is likely to win based on Jacobson, based on the interest that the state has in mandating vaccination. So we're not going to put it on hold. It was then appealed to the United States Supreme Court, where Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who has authority over the cases coming out of the Seventh Circuit, had the opportunity to review it and determine again if the vaccine mandate should be stayed, and opted not to, which tends to indicate that the Supreme Court is going to be favorable to vaccine mandates, and particularly vaccine mandates like the one instituted by Indiana University, which does have an exemption for people with religious objections and for people with medical objections, but does require unvaccinated students pursuant to those exemptions to wear a mask and to receive testing.
Well, it's interesting. When you were talking about this, you mentioned that some of these other cases are tied to this vaccine law from 120 years ago. Is that common, that these types of laws are used for other areas?
It has been with Jacobson v. Massachusetts. And there was an extension of that a little bit in a case called Prince v. Massachusetts in 1944, where parents were having their children distribute pamphlets to people in the street. And the state had a law prohibiting parents from employing children in certain fields, and that was one of them. And the parents said, well, the reason that we're having them distribute these pamphlets is because it's required by our religion. And the court again turned to Jacobson v. Massachusetts. And although Jacobson hadn't specifically addressed religion, it said that states have the ability to require that students be vaccinated even if their parents have a religious objection to that. And based on that, states can impose restrictions on the ability of parents to require things of their children, even if the parents assert a religious belief as a basis for that. And that has been cited by numerous courts of appeals and state Supreme Courts in upholding limitations or the removal of religious exemptions altogether. And now that isn't something that has happened in Indiana and certainly isn't likely to happen in Indiana, but there are several states in recent years in response to the measles epidemic of 2019 primarily that have limited or removed their religious exemptions from vaccination.
Well, I definitely want to get more into vaccines and teenagers, but we're going to have to take a quick break. In just a moment, we'll look into the rights of teenagers when it comes to their health and, in particular, getting vaccinated without parental consent. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. With us this afternoon is Brian Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University and author of the Bloomberg AHLA Treaties, Vaccine, Vaccination, and Immunization Law. Brian, when it comes to teenagers, there's often a divide on whether they should be able to make health choices and, in particular, get vaccinated without parental consent. Is there anything, I guess, in a law that would say a teenager could take their health into their own hands in times of a pandemic?
There are laws in different states around the country, and as with a lot of other areas and a lot of other things that are applicable to vaccine law, you know, it's very different from one state to the next. But there are laws in a lot of states that allow minors to make their own medical decisions under certain circumstances or based on an evaluation of a physician determining that they understand the consequences of the actions that they're taking. Indiana has a very limited set of laws with respect to this. Basically, a minor can make their own medical decisions if they are legally emancipated from their parents. And that, of course, is a very difficult thing to achieve. Or if they are effectively living on their own and supporting themselves and taking care of themselves in all their aspects. And that, again, is both an unusual circumstance and something that's not necessarily easy to prove. There are many other states that have either statutes or court decisions establishing what is known as the mature minor doctrine. And the mature minor doctrine basically says that if you're a minor, but a medical professional, usually a physician, determines that you do have the capacity to understand the consequences of your decisions and to make informed decisions, then you should be able to make decisions about your own medical care and will be allowed to decide things against parental consent. There are a number of states that have very specific areas where, for example, if you are a minor but you are married or divorced or widowed, or if you're a minor but you're a parent yourself and have a child, then you are lifted from the category of those whose medical decisions are made by your parents and sort of put into a category of persons who are able to make their own decisions. And, you know, historically, this goes back to the sort of feudalistic tradition from which the common law of England arose, where minors were essentially the property of their parents. And even for a lengthy period in that history where wives were the property of their husbands. So, you know, we go back for a very long time to this idea that, first of all, parents kind of have this ownership of their children, even if their children are very intelligent and informed and mature and are, you know, 16 or 17 years old. And at the same time that a child who becomes married or a child who becomes a parent somehow then has the maturity to make the decisions that they previously wouldn't have been able to make because of their age, you know, which is kind of an interesting thing if you consider that in our modern society, a minor who becomes a parent, that's usually something that occurs because they're exhibiting a lack of maturity as opposed to an unusual amount of maturity. But that is how the law has been structured. And then there are also states that allow minors who are employed in certain fields or have become employed in certain fields or who have joined the military, for example, or who have received a high school diploma to then make their own medical decisions. And that is something, again, that is scattered across the different states and no two are exactly alike in how they operate with respect to that. There are also a number of states that specifically have laws allowing minors to receive vaccinations. And some states, a limited number of vaccines. The District of Columbia, for example, has recently passed a law allowing minors over the age of 14 to consent to all vaccines recommended by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which is a CDC organization that recommends vaccines for minors for school mandates and has recommended COVID-19 vaccination for adults, but not for minors yet. So that's not something that's necessarily covered under statutes like that. But in many states, there are either statutes or court cases that allow minors to make all of their vaccination decisions if they're over a certain age or meet certain conditions. And recently, this has proved controversial. There have been efforts to expand such rights in states like Maryland and New Jersey that have met strong resistance from parents and have stalled in the legislature or not been passed. In the state of Tennessee, which has a mature minor doctrine that was set by the state Supreme Court decades ago, a state official who publicized the fact that minors have that right was actually terminated from their job because they were perceived as advising minors to receive COVID-19 vaccines against the will of their parents.
That's interesting. I mean, it makes me think, you know, how do teens go around the rules and get vaccinated if their parents are against it? Do they just go to another state?
Well, that's something that I haven't heard happening. And I think the reason for that is because a lot of teenagers and indeed a lot of adults are not aware that, first of all, there are these legal regimes in a number of states that do allow teenagers to make these decisions over the objections of their parents. And then in states where these regimes don't exist, including Indiana, they may not be aware that, first of all, that another state, a neighboring state like Illinois, for example, might allow someone to be vaccinated over their parental objections. And also, they might not have the wherewithal or the resources to travel to another state. And, you know, certainly we're not necessarily saying that minors who want to be vaccinated over the objection of their parents should try to abscond to another state where that is legal and obtain a vaccination there. You know, it's a difficult situation, and it's one that is probably most likely something that would be addressed either by courts or legislatures in the state. And, you know, there's certainly always an opportunity to seek to have courts determine that a mature minor doctrine should be applicable in a given state, following from its applicability from the fact that it has been adopted by so many other states that it should be something, for example, in the laws of Indiana, it might be possible to persuade an Indiana court of that. I don't know that the Indiana legislature would be inclined to bring that up. I'm certain that any such effort would meet with the same kind of resistance that it has in other states. So to a great degree, minors are kind of stuck if they're in a state that doesn't have any kind of provision for that. The most they can do is educate themselves and find out, you know, under what circumstances would they be able to be vaccinated. If there's someone who's able to actually become emancipated from their parents or able to demonstrate under Indiana law that they are living on their own and supporting themselves and already making their own decisions, they might have that opportunity. But otherwise, it's very limited. And therefore, minors who very strongly believe in vaccination and have parents who are opposed to it may find themselves in a very kind of taxing situation. And with respect to the childhood diseases in particular, there are federal government programs and many state government programs that fund childhood vaccinations for minors, and then those funds are no longer available when someone reaches the age of majority. So someone may find that they turn 18 and are now legally able to decide to be vaccinated for things like measles and mumps and rubella and so forth, but may find the cost of a series of vaccinations without assistance to be prohibitive. So those are some of the dilemmas that we face in the way that we have these very different regimes in the different states, where some of them allow minors to be vaccinated or to make medical decisions, and some simply have no provision for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of confusing and I'm sure frustrating for some folks trying to navigate that. But speaking of sort of mixed messages, something that I read today is that Florida is now instituting a $5,000 fine for anyone who asks for proof of vaccination. And I started thinking about other places in the world where you would actually get a fine for not being vaccinated or not wearing a mask. So there's a lot of mixed messages, I think, that are out there right now. What is your take on what's happening in Florida?
You know, the Florida situation is particularly difficult because it is a country that it is a state that has a substantial cruise industry where cruise ships depart Florida to go to other countries, even Caribbean countries or other ports in the world. And those countries may require that you show proof of vaccination in order to enter that country. So for the state of Florida to say to the cruise industry in particular, we're going to bar you from requiring that passengers show proof of vaccination before getting on your vessel when those same cruise ships know that they're going to have to provide proof of vaccination when they get to the port. That is creating a very difficult situation. And there is ongoing litigation where the cruise industry has sued and brought up a number of issues, including their rights of association to say that, you know, under the Constitution, we should be able to decide whether we want to allow passengers on the ship who are unvaccinated or not. You know, it's our business. We're a private enterprise. And that is kind of a dilemma that is arising around the country, where you have private enterprises that typically, you know, they're able to say no shoes, no shirt, no service. And now you're telling them, well, on this basis, on the basis of trying to do something to protect your customers from the spread of disease specifically, we're going to prohibit you from doing that. And it's a thing where at the same time, you see a lot of other states that say that, you know, we're going to facilitate doing that. And we're going to set up easy systems for businesses to confirm that potential patrons are vaccinated and to encourage that, and then to require vaccination specifically in fields such as healthcare or education, where people are going to be physically coming in contact with other people. So, you know, right now we're at a situation that's unlike anything we've ever seen before in the country. We've never had circumstances where vaccination mandates were widely prohibited by governments, or were efforts to require that either, you know, private business owners not check the vaccination status of people, or government agencies or municipalities not have regulations along these lines. You know, this is something that has never been done in this country before. And it really speaks to sort of the politicization of the issue, which is really a remarkable thing, because if you go back even a few decades, there has been constant widespread bipartisan support for vaccination. And, you know, that's reflected, for example, in the policies of the Reagan administration in enacting the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which is designed in large measure to promote vaccination by immunizing the manufacturers of vaccines from liability for vaccine-related injuries on the basis that, you know, that will maintain a healthy supply of vaccines. And, you know, so in many ways, Ronald Reagan is the father of modern vaccination law and process in this country. But at the same time, you know, the issue has become one that has become polarized through a political lens that is unique to this modern time and this modern pandemic.
When you mentioned, you know, this sort of reaction hasn't been seen before with folks preventing sort of mandates and things like that. In your field, in your expertise, have you been seeing anything different in this past year and a half that surprised you at all?
Well, that is certainly something that has surprised me, that there have been state governments that have gone so far as to impose limits on the ability of private businesses even to mandate vaccination of their own customers, people who are using their facilities, and you know, potentially of their own employees. So that's far beyond any kind of limitation on private entities than governments have previously engaged in. And, you know, really the level of opposition and fear to vaccination itself is kind of historic, and it certainly is fueled by social media. And, you know, we can't be sanguine about it. And, you know, it is at the same time necessary to address the fact that there are going to be some number of people, even if it's a very small number, who have a bad reaction to the vaccine itself. And there are some people who will not necessarily have a bad reaction to having coronavirus. So, you know, there's certainly room in there for people to say, well, you know, I don't want to be vaccinated, and for society to say, well, we're not going to do as was done in Boston in 1905 and fine you for not being vaccinated or otherwise, you know, penalize you. But at the same time, the balance that we would normally strike with that is to say, if you're not vaccinated and there are businesses or entities or lines of work or municipalities that want you to be vaccinated to take advantage of certain rights of employment or education, then, you know, you just wouldn't be able to take advantage of those. And, you know, we are seeing now people who are saying, well, I don't want to be vaccinated, but I don't want to give up anything either. I don't want to make any sacrifice in either direction. And that's genuinely novel to this period relative to past pandemics that we have had, and, you know, past efforts to stem things like smallpox epidemics and polio epidemics, where really communities have come together, and even those who wouldn't be vaccinated or couldn't be vaccinated took every effort to avoid the spread of disease and to follow whatever other measures were being instituted to that effect.
Well, we have about 30 seconds left. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel?
I think that the pandemic itself is going to last for several more years. And I think that's largely due to the fact that there's such a large portion of the population that is vaccine hesitant, and at the same time sort of hesitant towards taking other measures that will prevent the spread of the disease. And it doesn't help that most of the rest of the world outside the United States has very low vaccination rates as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Brian Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University and author of the Bloomberg AHLA Treatise, Vaccine, Vaccination, and Immunization Law. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Sove. Thanks for listening. This is All In.